Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Good evening. My name is Sobe. I'm an alcoholic. I'm such an alcoholic, too. I am so grateful to be clean and sober today and free from the throes of my addiction and my alcoholism. Sometimes I was actually just saying a couple of minutes ago to Lily how sometimes I forget how horrible it was. And, my life is so incredibly blessed today. It's not even funny. And, but then I'll hear of a relative or someone who is dead and, you know, it kind of brings me right back there. Or I'll see someone come back in fresh. And I really do try to listen closely when somebody comes back from being out there. And I try to see the fresh pain in their eyes and hear what they're talking about. And, you know, I try to hang on to that. I really do. By the grace of God and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not found it necessary to pick up a drink since March 16th of 1992. And for that, I am entirely grateful. I know deeply that it is but for the grace of God that I'm sober. Any success I may be having is far more His than it is mine. And I know that deeply. I didn't always understand what that meant, but I understand it now. I really do. And I stay connected. You know, not perfectly, but I really do. I rely on my higher power to keep me sober. And I know that there's nothing that's going to happen to me today that together Him and I can't handle. That's a different story. If I were to go off half-cocked, you know, then there'd be something to be concerned about. But I know that I can count on Him. Not on me, but on Him. Just really quick, my name Sobe is a nickname for Sobias. I remember when I was first coming to meetings and, I'd be like, how you doing? My name's Sobe. People would be like, that's good. Keep coming. I'm like, oh. No, my name is Sobe. But anyway, let's see. I came from a extremely alcoholic family. My mother took her own life when I was small, and my aunt raised the five of us, and what an awesome, noble undertaking. I've long since stopped ripping apart what, you know, her, and I've always called her my mom, and, you know, that, my uncle, my dad, long since stopped ripping apart and picking apart things that they did that I, you know, necessarily didn't like. And I'm just grateful. You know, I have two stepsons now, and I couldn't imagine taking five in, you know. But anyway, we lived in West Orange, and I'm also a strong roofing family. I'm a roofer myself now. My Uncle Bo has this huge roofing outfit there in West Orange, and my dad also had a roofing outfit himself, and he was a police officer at night, and he would roof during the daytime. I remember as a small child him coming home in the afternoon and taking a short nap for like an hour, you know, shower, quick hour or two nap, and then shining his shoes and going into the midnight shift. And we moved from there and, right around when I was like 10 years old, and my younger sister and I were extremely close at that time. And, so when we moved, she was in this car accident where she fell out of this van, and, she didn't die, thankfully, but she did land on her, the left side of her head, and, she had a blood clot. She was in a coma for like 28 days, and they were able to save her with brain surgery and everything, but she did not remember anything from before the accident. And that was pretty traumatic. I mean, I found myself in a strange place. I was in a new school and a new place to live, and my best friend didn't remember me, and I was basically hitting puberty at that point, not understanding what that was all about. And I remember starting to smoke at that time, and I remember the first time I drank was when we were really small. I remember those little orange juice containers. We would sometimes get a little bit of beer in them, and I loved it. And whenever for parties I would get set to go get another beer out of the fridge, I would always pop them and take a sip or two, you know. And so I remember also as a small child for a toothache, getting a little bit of whiskey on my on the finger, you know, and in there, and you know, right away I loved the stuff, you know. And I remember one New Year's Eve, the first time I actually got drunk. I was on a mission, and I say that I don't believe I ever crossed over a line. I believe I was always an alcoholic. I really do. I didn't drink socially. I mean, there were social times when I drank, but I was always on a mission to get hammered. And so I just don't play any games about that nowadays. But I remember it was a New Year's Eve, and my parents were away, and my oldest sister was watching my younger sister and I. And the two of them went out to Dunkin' Donuts, and I went down to the basement to the bar. Well, my brother had this big, huge mug. He still has it, actually, in his living room. It's about that tall. It's from Seaside. And in bright red letters, it says, "I bet you can't." And I took this thing down to the basement, and I just kind of made some kind of concoction with a little bit of everything. And I drank the whole thing. I was like maybe 100 pounds or something like that at the time. I got really sick. And I remember just enjoying the idea of doing it, and I loved how I felt. I loved being able to shut my feelings off and change my feelings. And I got sick, and thankfully, I look back nowadays, and I think of how God's grace protected me through the years while I was driving and through the things. And even that first time, I was blacked out long before I went to bed. And I don't remember going to bed. I don't remember getting sick. I just remember the next morning there was a lot of I had gotten sick all over the floor. And thankfully, I didn't drown. And so anyway, I remember enjoying that. I couldn't wait to do it again. And as the time went by, I got involved with some dry goods too, which I'm not going to elaborate a whole lot on. Just to say that I, as time went on, in the beginning, I had a lot of denial about whether I was an alcoholic or not. And, I just thought if I could stay off the dry goods, I would, you know, things would be okay. I didn't realize how thick the denial was, but, it's funny how you look back and realize, I look back and realize that everyone knew that I was an alcoholic, and I thought everything was in such cognito, and it wasn't. Everybody knew except for me, you know. But anyway, there was a lot of craziness throughout my teen years. I remember feeling when my sister had that accident, and I remember the deep sense of loss at that time. I made this decision that I was never going to get close to anyone again so I wouldn't have to suffer that loss again. And it's right when Pink Floyd, The Wall, was on the radio all the time. And I kind of just decided I wasn't going to let anyone get close to me. And I started at that point shutting my feelings off. And I was angry about that car accident, and I was angry about a lot of other stuff too. But I was talking earlier before the meeting about Catholic school, going to Catholic school, and that's another thing. I remember the August as a young child coming inside because the UPS man had delivered this package. And to my horror, my mom's putting this, what I thought was like an Easter outfit on, and I'm like, "Mom, this is not Easter time." And it was my uniform, and I hated it. And I did. I really did. I hated it. I hated going to Catholic school. I hated putting a tie on at that young age. And it was good for me, though. And my foundation for my faith was definitely laid there. I learned how to pray there, and I learned some basic foundation was definitely laid. I remember, though, getting hurt one morning or one day as a small child and running into, like, some bushes or something and scratching my side and just kind of being like, "How? Why would you allow pain?" And I just didn't understand anything at that age. And I realize now that whether it's physical or emotional or whatever the case is, pain truly is the touchstone to all spiritual growth. We grow through pain. You know, I don't grow when things are going wonderful and I'm kind of skating along and I'm sitting on a ton of money or whatever the case may be and things are going well. I tend to gravitate away from my higher power. You know, and when I tend to get through a time of pain or whatever the case may be, I grow through that. I really do. And I look back on those times where there's only one set of footprints, and it's when I was growing the most. It's when I was in the most pain. I can identify with God the most during that time. But so through my teen years, I got involved with a lot of the dry goods, like I was saying earlier. When I started driving, right away, I remember having a case of beer in the back seat behind my driver's seat and a bottle of something, whether it was Chivas Regal or Canadian Club Mist or 7-7, whatever the case might have been at that time. I also remember let me jump back a second, going to Puerto Rico with my parents and going on the snorkeling trip. And that was my introduction to Puerto Rican rum. And it was like a love affair at first sight. Immediately I was in love. And so I always enjoyed that too. And I remember through high school with my buddies drinking this Jim Beam. I mean, we would pour it in funnels together and pound it hard. And I remember, after a couple of years sober, I remember at first I would be uncomfortable if I saw alcohol at all. And then I would be comfortable at weddings and stuff. And I remember just being nervous when I would see people pounding it hard. And I kind of haven't really had a desire, you know, to drink for some time. I definitely am not cured, and I realize that. I have over the last couple of years, it's been about a year and a half now, but I had a drunk dream about a year and a half ago. It was the second one in like a 6-month period, and it scared the crap out of me. I gotta tell you, I sat up in bed, and I remember my feet hitting the floor, and I was in my brain already in a meeting talking about how I lost my sobriety, and then the realization hit me that it was a dream, and I cannot tell you the sense of relief. And I really do have a fear that I wouldn't ever make it back, but I'm so grateful that I don't have to drink today and get high and everything else, and I'm free, you know. And all of us actually in this room are a miracle, you know. I mean, the fact that I'm not drinking and getting high is a miracle. You know, it's the most natural thing for me to do is pour that stuff into my body as an alcoholic and an addict. And I mean, for us that are here, we're miracles. You know, we really are. We have a reprieve today. And so I remember when I started driving, having this case of beer in the back seat all the time and a bottle, and driving blacked out all the time. And again, I reflected after some time sober how I never got busted, driving back and forth to New York City, picking up stuff. I never got busted. I never ran anyone over. I never got a DWI. You know, I drove drunk every single day. And, you know, by mid high school, I remember coming down the stairs and cutting through my dad's office and opening up the shutter doors. And whatever he was drinking last night would be in front so I could get a couple of hits. You know, I could get 5 or 6 gulps and he wouldn't probably remember exactly where the level was. And then I would meet my buddies on the way to the bus, and we would start hitting it hard. And it was maintenance. And I just was running from my feelings, from my anger, from dealing with life. And I didn't want to face life. And I didn't want to face reality, I guess. I liked making everything into a party. And it kind of was my best friend, you know, my drinking and partying, and it was my escape from things. And I didn't realize how much it was hurting me until after some time away from it, you know. But I had such thick denial, and that's enough about what it was like. It was extremely out of control. Although I didn't get in trouble with the law or get DWIs, I just was out of control. I mean, I don't know how else to put it except that, out of control, you know, just wasted every day. And I did pick up a strong work ethic from my dad. And, you know, there were guys on the roof that I partied with. We partied on the roof hard. We worked hard and we partied hard. And I had this entitlement thing, like, I work hard, so I deserve this. And I remember protecting my addiction too. And if anybody ever kind of pointed at it or made reference to it, I protected it with a vicious vengeance. And that's not really normal, you know. I mean, but anyway, that's enough about what it was like. What happened? By the time I was 17 years old, I was realizing that something was wrong. I was definitely in denial, but I just had this sense of I got to get my stuff together. And I went through these – I was trying this geographical cure thing, and I tried going to college, and I got signed up and stuff, and I think I was like 2 weeks in. And I – what happened was I worked all day this one day, and after it ended, I picked up a friend from Flemington, and we went to Hillsborough to this huge keg party. And it was like all night long. The next morning, I drove her and dropped her off, and I was coming back from Flemington through Three Bridges, and I hit this telephone pole. I fell asleep, and I conked out, and I remember the snow crunching under my tires and lifting my head up, and I could see the beginning of the guardrail where it started, and I remember trying to pull the wheel to the left to get back on the road, and it was too late. I hit the guardrail, and I broke that telephone pole right in half. And the car landed sideways, and I landed sitting on my ankles on the passenger side door, and I climbed out of there. My ear was ripped, and I remember the first ambulance that got there was like a little 4x4 Jimmy or something, and this lady started taping up my ear, and when the cop got there, he wanted me to blow a breathalyzer. And I played off this sympathy routine with this lady EMT, and she kind of like, you know, pushed the cop away. And hours later, after the surgeon finished sewing my ear up, that same cop was in the hospital. He was like, I'm not going to bother having you blow a breathalyzer, but I know you were drunk. And anyway, I felt like I pulled the wool over their eyes. I was always lying and making excuses to protect my addiction. But I remember, just like I was starting to say before, feeling like there was something wrong and I needed to get my stuff together, and feeling like, you know, the military might be the answer. I joined the Army National Guard, and I left when I was 17 to go do that. And I didn't drink while I was in boot camp, and but I remember coming back from that, and within a year and a half, I remember I'd have to go once a month to my formation. And I can remember at like 3:30 in the morning getting annoyed that I had to stop partying, stop drinking, and go find my fatigues and get ready for formation. I was annoyed that this was getting in my way. And I like seriously annoyed and angry, you know, and some more things happened, and I try not to elaborate too much on the dry goods, but I had a situation where, I had some moments of clarity, if you will, where it's kind of like, I was realizing there's really something wrong here, and I gotta make a major change here. And, so, you know, I've often heard it said that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. And so I, what I did at that time, I got a conditional release from the Army National Guard to go active duty in the Navy. And my thinking was, I'm not going to be able to get my hands on anything illegal in the middle of the ocean. And I quickly found out in the Navy what exactly a drunken sailor is. And so, you know, I don't know what that thinking was all about, you know, but I often would listen to the committee up there in my head and get into all kinds of trouble. But I got kicked out of the Navy as a direct result of my drinking and my using. And that was kind of no excuse to make at that point. It was kind of in my face, and yet I was still in this state of denial. It's amazing how the denial is. I mean, looking back on it now, it's like I can't believe how much I was in denial and how shielded it was for me. How it was like hidden under all of these layers of self-justification or fear or something, you know, like but I got out of there, and I remember just this craziness and not really sleeping at all. Like, I couldn't sleep at all at that point. And it was like a difference between, you know, some of the dry goods that I was on and the drinking and just not having peace of mind. I couldn't shut the noise off and get any peace. And I remember my friend Dave suggesting that I go to a meeting. And really quick, I'm going to backtrack. I remember my friend Carrie, her mother getting out of the hospital in Trenton. She was an alcoholic, and her asking me to go to a meeting with her for support. And I remember feeling all noble at that time, going to this meeting with her for support. And I had to laugh later on, knowing, realizing in retrospect, looking back, she asked me to go because she knew that I desperately needed to come to AA, you know. And thank God for those things and for those situations, you know. But my friend Dave, I was on the phone with my friend Dave, and he was suggested that I go to a meeting, and I didn't connect that, you know, meeting equals alcoholic or anything like that. I just was like, something's got to change, and I kind of was willing to try it. And I went to this meeting in White House, and there was this guy, Billy Kay, sharing his story. And, I mean, honestly, looking back on that now, really there's nothing that Billy Kay and I had in common. But I remember sitting there, and I was paranoid. I was listening to this guy share, and on one hand, I was completely relating to him and identifying with him, and I felt like I was home finally, somewhere where I fit in and belonged. And on the other side of the coin, I was like, I had this paranoid delusion that the government or something was watching me, and I don't know what was going on in my brain at that time, but it was whacked. And but I remember after that going and checking into the flight deck at the Herndon Medical Center, and that started a couple of year period of me trying to get clean and sober, and I still had such amazing denial. And I remember the only thing probably that I did right during that time was I would let people know back at the meetings. You know, I'd come back in on Tuesday night or something, and I'd be like, I'm back on day two right now. I never accrued time that I didn't really have. And I respected the people that I saw in AA, and I loved going to the step meetings in Flemington because people shared about themselves. They kept it in the eye. It wasn't like this, you know, whatever you want to call it type of thing. And I really appreciated seeing the people that were sober because I could tell by hearing from what they were talking about that they had come from where I was at, and yet they were standing there or sitting there sharing about these marriages that they had and their relationships with their kids and these houses that they owned and these cars they were driving and these businesses they were running and all the stuff that was happening in their lives. And they were, you know, and I was like, so I basically the message I got early on was, you can get there from here. It's possible. And I'm not terminally unique. I'm not the only one, and I'm not totally crazy. I mean, well, I might be, but I'm not the only one who is. Yeah. We're all crazy, you know. I mean, I heard it said today, hey, we're all here because we're not all there, but that's okay, you know. I mean, I'm not okay, and you're not okay, but that's okay. But today we are okay, you know. It's so good to be clean and sober and free today. You know, during those first couple of years, I didn't grasp anything. I didn't really follow any suggestions except to keep coming back. I remember the first couple of times coming back, people were supportive. And after a while, mostly people started kind of giving me the cold shoulder a little bit. And there was one or two guys who kept telling me to keep coming and to don't stop coming until the miracle happens. Fake it till you make it. You know, I didn't understand exactly what those things meant, but, you know, I respected this person, this guy who was sharing that. He was from Wall Street, and a lot of his story correlated with Bill's, you know. But anyway, you know, that man is still sober today. I see him on retreat, you know. But anyway, I eventually stopped coming to meetings. I gave up trying. I remember I did celebrate 90 days once or twice during that time, but blew it. And I didn't understand about having a relationship with God. I didn't trust God. I didn't trust any people either. And so I remember at that time taking this formula of what I thought was going to make me happy, like X amount of money, have this girlfriend relationship thing, my own apartment, all this stuff. And I was working these two jobs to get this amount of money. And I was living with this young lady, and we had this apartment together. And I remember one night driving. I was delivering pizzas, and I saw this guy, Chris, that I knew from the Nechanic meeting. And he said to me, I'll see you on Tuesday. And the light turned green, and off he went. And I remember just like, whatever, I blew it off, you know. I didn't give it another second thought. And it's funny how, you know, I realize now looking back in retrospect that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And I didn't know what was good for me, and I didn't take care of myself, you know. And that following Tuesday night, I remember coming home from work and taking a shower and getting ready to go deliver pizzas. And the next thing you know, I'm looking at the clock. They're reading how it works. And I'm thinking how my boss at Alfonso's Pizzeria is going to be furious with me for not showing up. And then I got this sense of peace that everything was going to be okay. And I can't explain it except for it to be that. I just knew everything was going to be okay from that point forward. And I ceased struggling at that point and trying to do it myself, if you will. And I was released. I don't know how else to explain what happened. At that moment, though, everything changed. I realized that I wanted to get sober, and I got this willingness that came, an unbelievable amount of willingness. And I started doing things. I started taking suggestions. And I started going to step meetings, and I really started listening and doing the work. I started going to big book meetings. I started going on these spiritual retreats that these men were going on. And I remember going on those and getting an idea of this forgiving nature that God had. And always in my life up until this time, I didn't trust God. I was looking at him like ready to have these lightning bolts and ready to strike me down, and I was convinced that I was going to hell, and you know everything was miserable. And at this point in time, though, God was revealing this forgiving nature about himself to me, and he was revealing this power, and I was realizing that he could do it. You know, I could do with him what I could not do by myself. And I remember Rob, my sponsor at the time, telling me, willingness is the key. And I remember grabbing onto that with both hands and just thinking, if I can be willing, I'm going to get this. And doing the work, doing the footwork. You know, I remember people talking about being grateful and seeing their first butterfly and thinking, these people are whacked. You know, how could you be grateful to be an alcoholic? What are you talking about? And, oh, my God, I got to get out of here. They're fanatics. And I remember coming to an understanding once I started to receive the healing from working the steps. And that actually freed up the ability for me to have a relationship with God. And yeah, always I was so jammed up about all this stuff that needed to be cleared from the steps in order to have this upwards relationship. And I kind of always was trying to, like, grab myself by the bootstraps and get myself together, get my stuff together, get it all together. And the truth is that I couldn't get myself together. And, I mean, futile efforts are just that. They're futile efforts. But there is a power that is available to us. And I had to come to a realization first, though, that I couldn't do it, you know. And that was hard. It was hard for me to do that, you know. And I remember somebody sharing in a step meeting on step one about surrender to win and talking about the Japanese or something and saying, look how great they're doing now. And it was, you know, there are so many things spiritually that are paradoxical, or they're backwards, if you will, and yet they are what they are, you know. Let's see, we've got plenty of time left here. So what happened was I started going to meetings at that time, and this miracle of recovery happened. I remember meeting my friend Charlie, and Charlie and I used to go on speaking commitments together. When I moved up to the Phillipsburg area and started getting active in that area, I met Charlie, I met a bunch of other friends, and I met some awesome, amazing friends in recovery, and we were staying clean and sober together, and we were going to any lengths to do it. And that was an amazing thing for me, having this support group, these friends who understood me, and we were doing it together. And the sense of it's a we program instead of it's all about me. You know, because of that selfish nature of alcoholism. And I still am selfish, But there is a lot of other blessing in my life as far as my relationship with my wife and my kids. And I'm going to save a little bit of that for a little bit further afterwards. But I'm learning about the blessing that comes from others, from service, from perfect example, going into the prison. You guys made an announcement about that at the start of the meeting tonight. I've been going into the prison for a couple of years now, and it's like you think you're going to be a blessing to somebody, and you do nothing but get blessed. And it's like I would miss out on the amazing blessings that come from doing service if I stayed too selfish to do them. There is an amazing blessing that comes from serving others, and there's an amazing sense of dignity. I didn't talk about the self-loathing that I had when I was out there and not being able to look myself in the eye. I remember near the end of my addiction, even when I was in the military shaving, I could not look myself in the eye, least of all anyone else. And I remember people looking at me and saying, "Look at me in the eye, young man," and just not wanting to look anyone in the eye. And least of all, I could not look myself in the eye. I hated myself. And one of the things that has happened in recovery from working the steps, from maintaining a relationship with God as I understand Him, is that I don't hate myself anymore. And the whip has permanently been put down. And I didn't even realize how much I used to beat myself up, except when I would come to meetings, people would say, "Put the whip away. Stop beating yourself up." And, you know, those habits need to be changed, you know, but I've heard it said that a habit takes 21 days to become permanent, and that becomes second nature to us. And but anyway, I am absolutely able to look myself in the eye tonight. I have dignity and integrity, and I live to the utmost of integrity today, and I love who I am today. I believe I am the individual that God meant and created me to be. Not that I'm perfect and that I don't have problems. I'm not trying to paint a picture that isn't real. I do have problems. I have problems in my marriage. There are problems, but the thing of it is that we work through things today, and I deal with things today. I don't just leave them pile up until there's this humongous forest fire, if you will, whether it's finance or so on and so forth. And that used to be my MO. I was just running and running and running. And I don't have to run from anything or anyone today. I really do have a new freedom and a new happiness. There is such a blessing that comes from doing the work and from being correctly connected upwards. And truly, the literature is a blessing. There's so much truth and wisdom that's in the literature. I love when it says somewhere about when the spiritual malady is overcome, the rest of everything falls into place. And it's the truth. And I remember early on trying to get advice on how to fix all this crap. And people would just say, "Keep coming to meetings. Just don't drink and go to meetings," you know. And I'm like, "That's great. But, you know, what about the rest of the keys to the universe?" You know, and people are like, "Just don't drink and go to a meeting." You know, if your rear end falls off, put it in a wheelbarrow and take it to a meeting. Just do not pick up a drink just for today. That helped me early on. You know, I remember struggling. And I remember my first sponsor, Chris, that guy, Chris. You know, he had 5 years. I remember when he went back out, I extremely felt abandoned, and it reinforced the abandonment that I already had. And I remember wanting to just do what came natural, which was my coping mechanism, which was to use, you know, to run, to shut my feelings off. But not doing it and going to a meetings and sharing it and just making new habits. And it's never a good idea to pick up a drink. It's never a good idea to pick up a drink. And I don't have to drink today. You know, the good news is that we don't have to drink today. We can reach out. Over the years, I have never heard of someone who said a prayer and went back out anyway. Never. Never heard of anyone do that. You know, so I know. I remember hearing, too, there will come a time when the only thing between you and a drink is your higher power. And I remember coming to that place. That was it when Chris went back out. I remember wanting to drink and just not drinking.
And I realized after the time passed and went by, God was doing for me what I could not do for myself. And as the time went on from there, and I realized that God was trustworthy and that he was loving, I remember wanting to know him more and wanting more of this forgiveness and this good part of who God was and less of this, judging, damning God. And, prayer and meditation is an awesome thing. I talk to God like I'm talking to you guys. And, I had this cockamamie idea when I was earlier in recovery about how, I don't know what I thought. I had to put on some brown monk robe or something and like do hours of prayer or something. And it's like, that's totally not the way it is for me. Although sometimes I've gone through seasons where my prayer is, ritualistic, if you will. Learning the third step, the seventh step, and the 11th step prayer and praying those on a daily basis is a good thing. I mean, it's a good place. I like spending time with God when I'm alone, when I'm driving or when I'm working. I like spending time and I talk to God all the time. And, I believe that he is trustworthy. I know he is trustworthy. And, I remember hearing something on a retreat. Somebody said, anything that God has ever given me has been far better than what I wanted for myself. And that was like, dang, I remember this light bulb going off. And again, realizing, oh, God is trustworthy. And he has my best interests at heart. And, coming to know him and walking with him for a period of time now, I can testify that he is safe and loving. He doesn't always not let me walk through the fire. Like, I wish I could not walk through the fire. I walk through the fire sometimes, but he lets me walk through the fire without getting burned. You know what I'm saying? And he is there for me when the whole world has gone out. God is there for me. And he is not like us, and he doesn't let us down like I can let somebody else down. We're all human. We're fallible, But when I was like 7 years sober, or six and a half-ish, I met my wife and my two boys. I remember feeling upset that I wasn't biologically going to be able to have children of my own, a direct result of my addiction. And it was a lot of wreckage. A lot of wreckage from my addiction. And, I remember praying about that and kind of sobbing one day. And, it wasn't like audible or anything like that, but I remember clearly feeling God comfort me and just sort of, I can't really explain it into words. It was just like a sense of him wrapping his wings around me and telling me that it was going to be okay and that I was getting a grasp that he had a plan for me. And I remember realizing that my sobriety date was March 16th and remembering that it was one of my favorite verses with John 3:16. And I remember when I met my wife, just sharing with her, just being amazed. Her husband had passed away like 2 years before I met her and the boys. And we met in August and we married in January. We're coming up on our 13th anniversary on the 10th. And I should be so honored to have this woman and these two boys. I mean, they were six and like eight and a half. And I've had the privilege of raising them with her. And what an amazing relationship I have with them because of my relationship with God. And it's like you couldn't pay me to talk to my parents when I was a teenager. And I'm serious. You couldn't have paid me cash money to talk to my parents. I hated them. They were totally not trustworthy, if you will. And my boys and I, we talk about, I know everything that's going on in their lives. And although I didn't live the way I have taught them to when I was coming up through my teenage years, they know how I've walked in front of them since I've been with them, which is upright and with integrity. And I have taught them to respect their mother and to respect women. And they are 19 and 22 right now, and it's been an honor to just be with them. And they're in New York right now together with their mom, who was their Christmas gift to her, to go to the city. She loves to go over there and take these dance lessons because they're like really hardcore professional ballet on Broadway or whatever. And then, She likes to walk around over there. Her and I do that a lot, actually. But so that is amazing. You know, I remember reading that spot in step four, and the first time I read it, it was like a knife. There's a spot in the 12 and 12. I think it's the 12 and 12. Don't quote me exactly where. It's talking about that total inability to form a true partnership with another human being. And I remember the first time reading that, wincing with pain, because that was me to the T. And honestly, looking now on the miracle of recovery, I remember this guy, Glenn Lobdell from Bloomsbury. He used to always share, some of us are sicker than others, but you can get weller than well if you work this program. And that's happened. You know, I sleep every night now. You know, when I first started coming to meetings, I don't think I slept for 6 months before I came to meetings. And I sleep every night now. I'm at peace. I don't know. I'm incredibly blessed. I run my own business. It's a small business. It's humble, but it's my own. And I can play hooky whenever I want. And it's nice, you know. If we want to just take a day off and go to New York, we can do that. My wife and I can do that, you know. It's amazing. I'm just kind of blown away at what a blessing life is today, how different it is. I was thinking earlier about how I forget sometimes. I'm so different from the person that I was when I first started coming here. I was this scared, incredibly angry, basically young man, kind of like a deer in the headlights, sort of. I was furious. And I had no idea how to deal with my feelings, so I just shut them off and ran from them. And nowadays, I don't allow my feelings to rule me. I take a look at why I'm feeling a certain way, and, you know, I talk about it with people that I can trust. And but it's like when I was out there, I went by, if I was angry, I acted on that. And my feelings ruled me, if you will. And now it's like intellect over emotion, you know. My intellect is I choose what I do, and I'm correctable. I'm teachable, you know. When I was in my addiction, you could not talk to me. You couldn't tell me anything. You could have been Donald Trump trying to tell me about a checking account, and it was like you could not talk to me at all. I was not teachable. I could not listen or learn from anyone, and there, you know, scripture talks about a fool will not listen to correction, but if you correct a wise man, he will be wiser still. And, I try to listen and learn from others' wisdom nowadays. I really do. And, let's see. I have relationships now in my life that are long-term relationships, that are deep-rooted relationships. I'm active in my church. And the blessing that is there is amazing, how many relationships I am able to have there. I should be so honored to be a Sunday school teacher and, you know, to have relationships with all of these young people. And, you know, my sons, when they were 12, I took each of them through this young men's training program. And it had to do with, like, mentorship and teaching them about purity and dignity and, you know, different principles that are solid life principles, at the end of which we had a ceremony, like a knighting ceremony, where, you know, I bought this sword and I knighted Billy, my older one. And when Brent was old enough, I took him through it too a couple of years later. And I remember feeling at that time like I wanted to do it more. And I'll tell you something else. I've had this hole the size of Manhattan in my heart, like where a relationship with my earthly father would be. And being an alcoholic and in recovery, my dad drinks. And so it's always been like at odds, you know. And my healing for that started with my relationship with my heavenly father. And I have to tell you guys, a further amount of healing has come through fathering these two boys. And I've realized that what naturally will start to come out parenting is what was modeled for me. And yet still he is fathering them through me and unprogramming that and reprogramming me with kingdom principles and stuff that I learned here in the rooms about boundaries, learning how to set boundaries, learning how to respect boundaries from others. And after the two of them, when we got to this place where we're going now, I had the honor of taking 12 young men through this program and mentoring them. And the one pastor got on board with it, and there were three or four other dads that came along. But I was, you know, I feel like God called me to do it. And it was a 16-week program, and at the end of which we had this knighting ceremony. It was amazing. It was powerful. I can't express the amount of healing that I received through that. And it's like, that goes back to what I was talking about earlier, where I would miss out on the blessing that I'm going to receive if I'm not willing to do service, if I'm not willing to get involved in the lives of others and be unselfish. And really what happens when I'm willing to be unselfish is I get blessed. It's like, I think I'm going somewhere to be a blessing to somebody, and all I do is get blessed. That's how God works. And that ceremony, that day, standing there and having that honor, I mean, all 12 of them came up one at a time, and I was able to knight each one of them and have their father, their earthly father, speak a word of encouragement over them. It was powerful and incredibly healing for me. And those are the kinds of things that are in store for us. We stay sober. We do the work. We absolutely, there is power to stay sober. And there is, we do not have to drink and get high anymore. We are free. You know, it's but for the grace of God that I'm sober. Any success I may be having is far more His than it is mine. And I recognize that He is the power of why I'm sober. And yet there is a responsibility on my part to, when I, after that meeting at Neshanic and that willingness came, I remember that freedom that came in. Feeling that, knowing that everything was going to be okay, and then realizing there was a lot of work to do. And there's a line somewhere, I don't know if it's the 12 and 12 or the big book, it says there is plenty wrong with us alcoholics, about which plenty is going to have to be done if we are going to have a life of useful, happy, and contented sobriety. And I'll tell you right now, I definitely want to continue to enjoy Happy, Joyous, and Free. You know, I have looked at people who have stayed dry for long term, and I'm not taking their inventory to them, and I'm not talking about any names. I'm talking many years ago, and it's like I've also looked at people who were sober for long periods of time, and they were emotionally sober. They were able to deal with life on life's terms, and they were happy, joyous, and free, like the literature talks about. And those are the people I got next to, and it's like they told me early on, you know, if you want what we have, get next to us, find out what we did, and do it, and you'll get what we got. And it, that might sound incredibly simple, but it is. That's how it works. This is a program of mentorship. This is a we program. This is not an I program. And you know, it was hard for me in the beginning because I was self-reliant when I first came here, even though I only ever made a mess out of everything. I had to undo that. I had to unlearn self-reliance. And I heard people talking about my best thinking got me here, you know. And but it took me time to see that God was safe and trustworthy. But as I've continued to walk with Him, and I'll tell you right now, I love, absolutely love what He's been doing in my life since I've been turning my will and my life over to the care of Him. And He is absolutely hired. And I'm going to stay fired, you know. I really am. I haven't gotten myself kicked out of the Navy lately since he's been on the throne. We got a couple of minutes left here. I'll tell you something that really encouraged me early on when I couldn't grasp it. I remember reading this page on page 11 of As Bill Sees It. It talks about quality versus quantity. And I've read it several times over the years because it was so encouraging to me. It just removed whatever pressure at the moment I was feeling. It was such a relief. But it talks about this slip business. I would not think too hard of yourselves. Some of you are suffering from a needless guilt. And the Lord has laid out tougher paths for some of us than for others. And he is not asking you to be successful. He's only asking you to try to be. And that you surely are doing. Why not try just being a member instead of carrying all the AA on your back? And I got to tell you, when I read that page, I just felt the world fall off of my shoulders. And I've been practicing letting it go ever since, you know, and turning it over. And I'm not in control, you know, and I can deal with life on life's terms today. And I'll tell you what, when I'm going through something that's hard, at least I can feel it today. And I can grieve in a healthy way instead of stuffing it. You know, I cry when I need to cry. I understand what it means now to see a butterfly. It's amazing. I love flowers, man. I mean, you know, I remember thinking how unmanly or something that was. And I just wanted to be so manly, you know. But I get my wife roses all the time. And I think I get them more for me than I get them for her, you know. And it's like, that's okay. That's not a bad thing. It's all right if I enjoy them. She loves them too, you know. But it's the simple things in life. I was reflecting recently about how I am not a rich man in the eyes of the world as far as financially goes. But honestly, I'm the richest guy I know. I really am. I mean, I have stuff that I couldn't buy if I had all the money in Manhattan. I mean, there's a lot of duckies quacking in Manhattan, you know. But, I mean, I have stuff that I couldn't buy if I hit the lottery for $150 million. You know, you cannot buy peace. You can't do it. You can't buy real authentic relationships. You can pay for employees, but you cannot buy authentic relationships. You can't buy faithfulness. And I have peace. I am so blessed, and I am truly grateful to be clean and sober. I am grateful that I'm an alcoholic, you know. I'm grateful that I have this recovery program that is spelled out so simply for me. And I am grateful for the relationships that I'm able to have because I'm sober and because I have a relationship with my higher power. And I know as I stay connected correctly upwards, he allows me to stay connected sideways to my wife and my sons. And I'm going to close on a note about this, and it just has to do with apologizing when need be. It's kind of like a step 10 thing with my kids. And it's a matter of I remember Fonzie laughing at Happy Days because he couldn't say I was wrong. Fonzie was like, I was wrong. And everybody laughed, and it was a big joke. But, I mean, that was our generation coming up. And it's like I learned how to say, to take ownership for something. And I have gone to my kids, both of them, on many occasions because I blow it. You know, I blow it at times. I have gone to them and said, I'm sorry for the delivery. The delivery was horrible. You know, if you could possibly forgive me for the delivery and try to take a look at what I was trying to communicate to you. I've realized, this is my closing remark here, I've realized that what I say to them and others holds about only 5% of weight. What I do, how I walk, how I live my life out, how I respond to things, and what my checkbook says, that holds 95% of weight. And I am so grateful to be clean and sober. Thanks so much for letting me share. I hope I brought you to the news.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.